Emily Dickinson may be our favorite literary recluse, but according to Lyndall Gordon's new biography, Lives Like Loaded Guns, she wasn't the quaint, fragile woman we have been led to believe she was. Her brother's charred late life affair was conducted in Emily's house and created a fissure in the family that affected her greatly and led to a struggle to control her poetry and her legacy after she died. The book is published by Viking. I'm very pleased that it brings Lyndall Gordon to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Why does Emily Dickinson's private life continue to fascinate so many people? Is it because her poems are so expansive in their scope that we can't imagine them coming from someone whose life was so confined?
Yes, well, there's been an endless mystery about Emily Dickinson because of her reclusiveness. She was called the myth, even in her lifetime in Amherst. And I do think that although her poems appear confessional, and she obviously writes often in the first person, the words are almost pushed apart by her idiosyncratic punctuation, the dashes, so that it's almost as though the mystery is resonating within the poem.
Although the punctuation, we'll get to that later, was changed after she died, wasn't it?
Yes.
Because somebody felt that there should be more clarity?
Yes. Editors in the 19th century, this was part of the reason she couldn't publish, because editors in the 19th century felt that she was ignorant. In fact, she was highly educated. She'd been to college. Her punctuation was deliberate. Her off-rhymes were, I'm sure, deliberate. But poems were tampered with, and she cared about that quite passionately. We know from one letter where a poem about a snake was published at the height of her output in the early 1860s, and she wrote a letter to say that poem was robbed of me by a comma in the third line.
You seem to be drawn to subjects, women who created great works despite the confines of their societies.
Yes, I've written on Mary Wollstonecraft and on Charlotte Bronte, on Virginia Woolf too. Yes, I am fascinated by a sense of duality, particularly in 19th century women's lives, when on the surface there is a decorum, an obedience. They have to do it because they don't want to be outcasts. On the other hand, there is something seething underneath, an energy, a creativity. As Emily Dickinson said, I've got a bomb in my bosom. Nay, hold it, it's calm. I think she's talking about a feat of self-control. I'm not saying she wasn't domestically very able, and that she was a domestic person and she loved gardening. And you've just had a great show in New York at the New York Botanical Gardens, recreating her garden. But she also had this nightlife. She actually wrote her poems, certainly at one stage of her life, between 3 a.m. and 12 noon. She would have needed a father to agree to that, and he did indulge her. But she had, shall we say, an alternative existence.
Well, you said that, like Henry James, you're interested in the pattern in the carpet. What do you mean by that in relation to Emily?
Yes, I'm using it in Henry James's sense.
Of course, we look for that in his story as well.
Yes, yes. He had a sense that if you have a really great writer, and in that story where he mentions the phrase, the title is The Pattern, The Figure in the Carpet, there's a great writer, fictional creation called Verica, and everybody's hunting for the key to his work. There's a sense that there's a recurrent pattern in his work. I mean, what comes to my mind just off the top of my head is, say, if we take the poems of T.S. Eliot, one sees his poems look difficult, but once you've cracked the code of any one of his poems, you have the clue to all of it, which is a spiritual search, a soul's journey. And I don't want to be too reductive about any particular writer, but I think that in a great life there is, it's as Yeats said, a great life isn't the muddle most of us are when we sit down to breakfast. It's been designed, it's directed.
Well, you've likened your process of writing biography to that of a scientist with a hypothesis. What hypothesis did you start with here?
Well, I started. Well, the hypothesis is not something I would pull out of the air. It's something that comes to me through loving a writer's work. What I've loved Emily Dickinson's work ever since it was read to me in Africa when I was a child. And what most gripped me were her volcanic poems, A Still Volcano Life, which she goes on in that poem to say it's conducted at night when it is dark enough to do. Do for Emily Dickinson is right. And so there are numerous references to Etna and Vesuvius, to guns going off, to revolver, to earthquake, to speaking through buckled lips. So that I'm not saying this is the only strain in Emily Dickinson, because of course she writes poems about a garden or a snake, but there are a fascinating number of explosive poems. And that's for me, this is my Emily Dickinson, though other people will have their own.
Well, in the story you tell, there are a lot of explosions. They aren't always within Emily, but they're all around her.
They're both within and around her, I would say. Within, I believe she had what she called a sickness, and that it would explain much, if my guess is right. Around her is a family, as you've said in your introduction, there's a family split. And so she's actually an explosive person in the midst of an explosive family. And I wanted to get away from the legend of Emily Dickinson as demure, sentimental, suffering from disappointed love.
She went to the first college established for women, Mount Holyoke, you say that she had a scientific education. What do you mean by that?
Well, I simply mean that she chose to take quite a number of science courses, and particularly geology was the exciting science of the day. She was at Mount Holyoke in 1847-48, so it was a time when the discoveries of geology were making inroads into faith.
But was it significant that she rebuffed the religious proselytizing of the founder of Mount Holyoke?
Yes, she had, perhaps we could call it an outcast experience when she was at Mount Holyoke. She only stayed a year, but she has this delightful poem where she tackles faith. She stood up to Miss Lyon, the head of her college, and later she wrote, "Faith is a fine invention when gentlemen can see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency." She was delightfully witty. Miss Lyon consigned her to the lowest of three categories of student. There were the hopeful. There were the saved. Then there were the hopeful, and then at the bottom of the rung were about 30 no-hopers, and that's where she cast Emily Dickinson.
And it would be interesting to look at who the top ones were in comparison to Emily Dickinson.
They were the nobodies.
She should have put her in the achievers.
Yes.
There was much talk of various illnesses during her life. Her family took her out of college to recuperate for a month. And you suggest that the problem was epilepsy?
Yes. So far as I can see from the evidence I collected, that the facts point towards that, and it seems corroborated by many of the explosive, what were called by a critic spasmodic poems she wrote. But it can only be a guess. But if I'm correct, then it would explain her seclusion, because epilepsy in the 19th century carried a stigma.
Well, Dostoevsky incorporated his epilepsy into his art, and I don't know if that caused there was a any kind of stigma there. But would it be different for a woman than for a man?
Yes, that's what I would have. I would suggest that in certain men, like Julius Caesar, Muhammad, Dostoevsky, fame could override the stigma, but in the case of a woman, it was unladylike, and she would have been buried in a silence. And it's all the more remarkable that out of that silence, out of that seclusion, Emily Dickinson forged a voice that could outlast her time.
Well, there also was a feeling perhaps that it would prevent her from becoming a wife and a mother, although would that have been something she might have wanted? There were hints of that she might have had affection for women, no?
Well, there's some basis for that in that she wrote ardent letters to women. She wrote one poem, which wasn't published till the 1940s, about amputate my freckled bosom, make me bearded like a man. I mean, that's quite a daring statement about a sex change. She had intense relationships with women, but
Susan Gilbert,
her beloved sister-in-law, the keenest reader of her poems. But there's no final evidence either way.
There's one of the most important figures in this book is Mabel Loomis Todd. Her brother had an affair with her when he was 54, and this sounds like something out of today's scandal sheets. They both married. She continued to maintain her relationship with her husband.
Yes.
There's all sorts of talk of voyeurism and threesomes and other stuff in this. We're talking about the 1860s, 1870s?
No, we're talking about the 1880s, early
1880s. That explains it, then.
Well, no. I think it was remarkable. I think that it's hard to talk about it briefly because each person involved in this affair, there was a story behind it. There's an abyss behind them, which explains how this really unlikely affair happened. Because Austin Dickinson was a man who would be by nature faithful, and he was very upright and prim, and he disliked laughter on Sundays. I mean, he wasn't the kind of person you'd think of as a candidate for the folly of passion, but he fell very much in love with his young faculty wife.
Well, Mabel does seem like an extraordinary woman.
She was.
It would have just been an affair, although there are a couple of interesting things. They conducted their trysts in Emily's house,
yes.
And Emily never met her face-to-face. Yes. How did that happen if Emily was a recluse?
Well, Emily Dickinson clearly set her face against. She took a stand against the affair. I think this is fresh information. Most people would think of Emily Dickinson as remote from trouble, just keeping away upstairs in her room. I think since Mabel Todd and her lover were in the house about three times a week for 2 to 3 hours at a time, and blocking Emily Dickinson's, if one sees the layout of the Dickinson homestead, you would see that the lovers would have blocked Emily Dickinson's access to her conservatory and her desk, second desk, she avoided Mabel deliberately.
Well, Susan is the logical curator of Emily's poetry, and yet Mabel wound up in control.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, Susan, to do her justice, did make an attempt soon after Emily Dickinson's death to send one of the poet's poems to the foremost New York editor of the day, Richard Watson Gilder of Century Magazine. He was a tasteful man at the time. He was serializing Henry James's The Bostonians, but alas, he rejected Emily Dickinson. And I think that Susan, who wasn't used to the media, to editors, I think she would have been very daunted by that rejection, whereas Mabel Loomis Todd was used to publishing. She was a professional. She acquired a very early domestic typewriter. Really, I don't know how I've seen the typewriter in Amherst. I don't know how she managed. It's too primitive for words. But she typed up a couple of the poems, showed them to Lavinia, Emily Dickinson's sister, and the rest is history. Lavinia said, right,
Although she did change the punctuation in some
cases.
Yes,
she did.
But do we know what the original punctuation was?
Well, the manuscripts, yes, survive. So the only way to see Emily Dickinson's real intentions is to put those poems, well, either to edit them in a facsimile edition or to put them on the internet, which a Dickinson scholar, Martha Nell Smith, is doing at the moment. She's taking about 30 of Emily Dickinson's poems and letting the public see what it was they really looked like.
Lyndall Gordon is the author of Vindication, A Life of Mary Wollstonecraft, a New York Times notable book. Also Virginia Woolf, A Writer's Life, which was the winner of the James Tate Black Prize for biography. Biographies also of T.S. Eliot and Charlotte Bronte. And she is a senior research fellow at St. Hilda's College in Oxford, England. Her latest is Lives Like Loaded Guns, Emily Dickinson and Her Family's Feuds. It is published by Viking. You have another subject yet?
I have something deep in my heart I've always wanted to do, and I feel I was born to do, and that is a memoir of my mother, who's actually quite an Emily Dickinson character. She was quite secluded. She wrote poetry. She didn't publish it.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.